When you go to vote on Tuesday, for many state offices, you won't have a choice in who to vote for. Why? We look at all the uncontested races on the ballot. Also, when people who are arrested can't afford bail, the consequences can be catastrophic.
I was devastated because I knew that my family couldn't come up with $25,000. I lost my business that I had going into jail. I lost my home.
That's Livette Mays on WTTW Chicago Tonight. We'll speak with WTTW reporter Paris Schutz, State Representative Carol Ammons, and others who were trying to reform the bail system. But first, what everybody's talking about today. The Cubs are going to Game 7 of the World Series.
I mean, we've never seen a World Series in our lifetime. So this is just indescribable. It's too much stress. It really is.
That's fan Mike Metzger in Rock Island after last night's win. That's coming up right after the news. Stay tuned. This is the 21st.
2-0. High fly ball to left center. At the wall. Grand slam. 7-0 Chicago.
What a night for Cubs fans and Illinois. The Chicago Cubs have fought back from being down 3-1 in the World Series to force a Game 7 tonight. That was Joe Buck on Fox calling Addison Russell's grand slam that helped the Cubs cruise to a 9-3 win last night. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we're talking about not just Cubs, in a few minutes about how many politicians running for state office don't have an opponent. And we'll also be looking at an effort to reform the amount of money people have to pay for bail. But first, the Cubs. We've been following the team's playoff run all month. Last night, they beat Cleveland to force a winner-take-all Game 7 tonight in the World Series. If the Cubs win, they'll end not just a 108-year World Series championship drought. That's actually the longest drought in baseball history. We went to Kavanaugh's Hilltop Tavern in Rock Island, Illinois, to watch the game with some fans last night. Let's take a listen.
I mean, we've never seen a World Series in our lifetime, so this is just indescribable. It's too much stress. It really is.
It's very exciting. I thought they'd win tonight, and I think if they win tonight with this momentum, they're going to go all the way this year. So,
my favorite player is Anthony Rizzo. He's a lot of fun to watch. He's dynamic. He makes things happen. And he's got a really great last name, too.
I love the team so much. I think it's fun to watch them all, just the camaraderie they have.
People singing that song badly all across Illinois. That's what we heard last night. You heard from Cubs fans Mike Metzger, Katie Monford, Dan Metzger in Rock Island. Thanks to Augustana College Senior, one of our former interns, Ben Thomas Payne, for recording that audio for us, and to Sean Newman for producing it. We've been checking in with WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Raceout throughout the playoffs. She joins us on the phone now from Cleveland, where she was covering the game last night. She'll be back again covering Game 7 this evening. Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
I just want to take a second here, right? Not only are you covering Game 7 of the World Series, it's Game 7 of the World Series for the Chicago Cubs, being one win away from ending a 108-year drought. How are you feeling this morning, Cheryl?
I'm a little tired, but it's exciting. It's going to be history if they do it. And I tweeted it out. This would be my 12th championship that I've covered. So, and this is the crown jewel.
What is it like this morning in Cleveland?
Well, it's pretty passive right now, because I'm sure the anticipation is going to get stronger and stronger as the day goes on. I mean, last night they had both the Cavs playing again at the same time as the Indians, and so there was a lot of activity going on in that whole area. In fact, the Cavaliers Stadium, they had the game going on their video TVs, and then LeBron James came over.
I was going to say, LeBron came over after the game, because he was at the game for the last part of it. Okay.
How wild is that?
Did you expect last night's game to go the way it did, especially how the Cubs came out so strong dominating the game?
I thought they could win the game, because I thought this particular pitcher, Josh Tomlin, would have a difficult time on 3 days rest. And I thought that the Cubs, the way they had played on Sunday night, would carry over. Can it happen today? I don't know. But I thought last night was going to be key, and they did it early. you know, when Chris Bryant had that home run, it set the table. And then when Addison Russell had the grand slam, it just closed the door on the Indians.
And, Cheryl, when we think about that misplay, the error in the outfield mm-hmm. that Cleveland had in the first inning, I think Cubs fans have spent their whole lives watching things like that happen to them, right? I'm thinking of Brent Brown's drop fly ball in 1998 coming to mind. I mean, the idea that they just missed, I was like, is this happening? Did they just miss the ball?
Yeah. I mean, and it's not considered an error because no one touched it. It was called a double. But, you know, it should be considered an error. But you had a rookie center fielder in Tyler Naquin. And he just misplayed the ball. And the whole, you could feel it in the stadium. Progressive Field, you could feel the air just went out at that point because that was a devastating blow right at the beginning of the game.
What do you think it's like for Cubs fans to be on the other side of moments like this?
I think it's disbelief. I think for fans to be going through this right now, I think it's a dreamlike state because you can't imagine this after so long and so many things going wrong that it finally could be right. And even if they don't win, they are a team built for the future. So it's not like it's all doom and gloom. I really think that there's a lot more positives no matter what happens tonight.
Right. I think the fact that they won, and that was the conversation we were having around the office this morning, right? The fact that they made it to game six, that they won game six, going to having this be a 7-game series, ultimately, no matter the outcome this evening, has to mean a lot for Cubs fans.
It sure does. And actually, it's really the whole country is awoken to the Cubs. You know, they've really are invested now in the young players, in the Rizzos, in the Russells, in the, you know, all these young players are on this team are excitable and they're fun to watch and they play well. And it's really good for baseball. Baseball always needs to have some team to come to the forefront and carry it because now you have so many things to watch and see, and baseball really needs the Cubs right now.
For all of the people who have jumped on the bandwagon, people who do not understand baseball as well as diehard Cubs fans, what should either of those groups be watching out for this evening?
Tonight's going to be interesting to see how Corey Kluber, the Indian starter who is going after history, trying to be one of the few pitchers to win 3 World Series games. Going to be hard. He's, again, on 3 days rest. And these Cubs bats came alive against a curveball last night. And not that Tomlin is the same as Kluber, but it does help. The other thing is going to be watch how does Kyle Hendricks handle it. They do hit him a little bit because they're a contact team. But he's got nerves of steel. So the pitching is going to be interesting. And then watch how these managers, Terry Francona and Joe Maddon, use their bullpen. It's going to be interesting because Joe Maddon's going to go to John Lester and John Lackey if he has to.
Well, and that's the thing, Cheryl, because it's game 7. It's not like anybody needs. I mean, this is really it. You're not going to rest anybody. What do we think Joe Maddon's going to do? Is he going to have how many pitchers do you think he's going to have in this game tonight?
Every single one that he has to use. He'll use all of them. Inning by inning, pitch by pitch. That's what he has to do tonight. You know, in the middle of July when we're sitting there in the hot sun and, you know, in the press box and we're watching a manager going out to the mound 3-4 times to take out a relief pitcher, we turn to each other and go, is he managing the 7th game of the World Series? We always say that. Tonight, that's when it's true.
He is actually managing the 7th game of the World Series. So what's Joe Maddon going to do? And I think for people who don't care about sports, the storyline of these two teams and their histories really is a remarkable thing that's going to happen this evening, isn't it, Cheryl?
It is. It's intriguing. I mean, you're talking about long droughts. You're talking about fan bases that have been faithful to their teams.
Decades.
You're talking about two teams that rebuilt themselves to be winners. And that's what we're seeing.
WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Reisnout from Cleveland giving us the lowdown ahead of tonight's Game 7 of the World Series. Thanks, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it. The Cubs are on their way.
Hey, hey,
the Cubs
are going.
You're listening to the 21st. Illinois voters go to the polls next Tuesday. More than 60% of state races in Illinois are uncontested, meaning there's only one candidate on the ballot. Even if in the races that do give voters a choice, only about half of those are really competitive. That's based on an analysis the Chicago Tribune just did. Why is it the case that we have so few of both parties putting up opponents for races at the local level in Illinois? How much does this relate to the effort to redraw legislative districts and the political quagmire we've seen in Springfield the past couple of years? And perhaps most importantly, is there anything we can do about it? Joining me now to talk about this, joining me to discuss this, is Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He's on the line from Springfield. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nala.
We've also got with us Dan Petrella. He's the Springfield Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprise Newspapers, which includes the Herald Review, the Pantograph, the Southern Illinoisan, and others. Hey, Dan, it's great to have you back with us as well.
Hi, Nala. Thanks. Good to be back.
Chris, let's start by looking at these numbers. On Tuesday, we've got all 118 House seats, 40 of 59 Senate seats on the ballot. By various calculations, we've got anywhere from 60 to as much as 67% of these races with just one candidate in them. Has this been a common problem in Illinois?
Well, certainly since the new constitution and even since the, in the cumulative voting era, we still had that problem. It's not just Illinois. State legislative contestation around the country is low, let's say. I mean, but it varies a lot from state to state. For example, Michigan, for example, virtually all the legislative seats are contested, which means that there's somebody at least on the ballot. Now, there's a difference between just having people on the ballot and actually viable potential winners on from both.
But we don't even have people on the ballot.
Right. Exactly. And, we are one of the worst states in the nation in terms of that.
And why and how much do you think this has to do with earlier this year, we had so much discussion about how legislative districts are redrawn, an effort, an attempt to get that on the ballot to have voters have an opportunity to have a say in how this is happening was rebuffed by the Supreme Court. How much of this has to do with the way legislative districts are drawn?
Well, nobody can really say with a definitive answer exactly. This is all because of the gerrymandering or something. But it's certainly going to be a piece of the puzzle. I mean, one of the issues with state legislative races and any district, the smaller the district, the more homogenous the district is going to be almost by definition, right? So at the national level, a very heterogeneous electorate. At the state level, it's less heterogeneous. Most states are more homogeneous than the national. And then when you get down to these local, local races and state legislative races, which are very, fairly a few number of people in them compared to, say, the state as a whole, because people tend to sort themselves out and live in places like people like themselves, and people like themselves tend to think like themselves, you get sort of areas that are largely, one party or the other is going to win in this general geographic area. And so what that leads the opposition party, if you're in an area where there's very few Republicans, it's very difficult to get somebody to run for the Republican be the candidate for the Republicans to run for the general election, because they know they're going to lose, and why do they bother?
Mm-hmm.
And then you lay over top of that an attempt through districting and arguably to make that even more kind of exacerbate that situation. Even though gerrymandering is not only about making districts homogenous, there's some subtleties to it that still probably exacerbates that problem.
That's Chris Mooney. He's the director of IGPA, the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Dan Petrella, you've been writing about the power of incumbency recently. Let's just remind everybody. So we've got more than 60% of state races only have one candidate on the ballot. Even where races where voters have a choice, only about half of those are really competitive. You gave an example in your reporting from the 2015 election where only one incumbent out of 124, that's former state senator Mike Jacobs, a Democrat from East Moline, lost in the general election. What did that race hint at in terms of not just money and power, but the power of incumbency in Illinois politics?
Sure. That race up in the Quad Cities area actually was sort of the exception to the rule when it comes to incumbency. based on some national data from legislative races across the country, the National Institute on Money and State Politics did a report looking at the 2013 and 14 election cycles and found that 91% of incumbents running in general elections across the country were reelected, and that went up to 94% when the incumbent had raised more money than his or her opponent. And in that race, Senator Neil Anderson, a Republican from Rock Island who now represents that district, raised a little bit less than Jacobs did, who is the incumbent. But with some help from the state Republican Party and the Republican Senate Campaign Committee, he was able to close the gap to about $200,000 or so, which sounds like a lot of money, but in this scheme of things, it really isn't. And
for this election cycle, but for a local race, $200,000 can make a big difference, especially 2 years ago, right?
That's true. That's true. And even though, you know, Anderson didn't quite outspend Jacobs, he had enough money to really compete and was able to defeat an incumbent there. And that's sort of the formula the Republicans are trying to use this time around in several more races around the state in areas that they think they can unseat some incumbents or pick up some seats that have previously been held by Democrats who are not running for reelection.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dan and Chris. As Dan alluded to, we've got record-breaking money involved in this election in Illinois. So we're going to be talking about that as well as incumbents, uncontested races. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. By the way, if you have questions or comments, you can always tweet to us. Our handle is 21STShow. That's 21STShow. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you vote on Tuesday, know that for the majority of state races, there's only going to be one candidate on the ballot. That's more than 60% of state races in Illinois being uncontested. We're talking about that right now, as well as the empower of incumbents who are running for office with Chris Mooney, who directs the Institute for Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He's on the line from Springfield, along with Dan Petrella, who's the Springfield Bureau Chief with Lee Enterprises Newspapers. And Dan, you have been talking about, we were just talking about how much money is involved with this race in Illinois, and how much money is Governor Rauner spending to bet against incumbency in some cases in this election?
Sure. So as of Friday, when I last checked, the governor and his wife, Diana Rauner, had donated about $31.6 million of their own money, either to various Republican Party political committees or to conservative political action committees that are then funneling that money to other candidates or spending on behalf of candidates in what are called independent expenditures.
And what we're seeing, Dan, is then we're also seeing now in some new data today, we'll tweet out that Chicago Tribune article that has all of the numbers of how much Democrats are now spending, how much unions and others are putting into races in opposition to the Republican Party to support Speaker Madigan. Are we really seeing sort of this kind of everyone trying to up the ante as much as possible and just pour as much money as they can on either side?
That's sort of what it seems like, and I know you know, the money is changing hands between committees and candidates and things so quickly that even some people who track this stuff all the time are sort of waiting for the dust to settle to do the final tally of how much is actually being spent, because it can get kind of distorted when, you know, just to go back to the example of the governor, if he makes a contribution to the Republican Party and then they hand that to their House political committee, and then that gets distributed to various candidates. Depending on how you count that, it can look like a lot more money than it actually is, because it's sort of the same pot of money changing hands. So it's really going to be tough to say until all the final reports are filed in January how much was actually spent on this election.
Chris, I wonder how much you think is this money in this race reshaping politics, or do you think it's temporary just because of the extraordinary wealth that we have with Governor Rauner? Do you have a sense? I don't know if you do.
Well, I don't think anybody really knows right now. it is certainly an unusual situation. And I think the sort of structurally the way it's coming in, especially on the Republican side in particular, that you suspect that at least it's possible that this could just be a temporary blip. And the reason I say that is because if I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but between Governor Rauner and his wife, Ken Griffin, who is the richest man in Illinois, who is the sort of hedge fund guy.
Hedge fund billionaire.
A guy named Eline, I think it's Richard Eline, who's in trucking, I believe. And then to a lesser extent, Sanzel, who's throwing in sort of $8 million or something like that. I mean, these are very few people putting a lot of money in to, and you just heard what Dan said, some 30 some million dollars out of the Rauner's personal checking account. I mean, that it's hard to imagine that could be sustained, in the long run, and because it's really based not on structural changes in the electorate, but in the whim and the personal decisions of four or five people. So yeah, I don't, maybe they'll keep in it for a long run, but I don't know, or maybe their spouses will say, hey, wait a minute, I know if I was spending $36 million out of my checkbook on a campaign, number one, the bank would have a problem with that, but also I think my wife might say something to me after a while. Really, you really need to put that much money in there?
Yeah, sure, Chris. One last question for both of you. And Chris, I wonder if you could start. What do you think this says to the Illinois voter? Whether it's a question of only having one candidate on the ballot or the power of incumbency. You said you think Illinois is one of the worst in the country for this. What do you think this does to sort of the psyche of individual voters and then kind of a broader effect on the state?
Well, I mean, we're one of the worst in the country for contestation. And I think that the individual voter that, when you go into the voting booth and, most people are not drawn to go to the voting booth for the state legislative race. In fact, most people don't really know what the state legislature does. They don't know who their state legislator is. And they're going to vote for president or vote for Senate or, those sorts of, and then they look down the list and they see, well, there's only one person on there. That's got to be a little demoralizing. I'm sure a lot of people might think, well, why even bother? That can't be good. But likewise, when you see, this being played out sort of like, gods up above us with so much money, and you can't turn on the TV without getting slapped with commercial after commercial that are just, just very negative and very painful and really downright confusing for a lot of people. I don't think this helps, the general attitude about, this is a democracy, we're all in it together. And, so that's kind of worrisome to me.
Dan, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think just, in some downstate areas, maybe where state legislators are some of the more prominent political figures, they might be a little more well-known than in the Chicago area, for example. And sort of like with Congress, people tend to dislike the institution, but a lot of them do like their local guy or woman who is representing their district. So there might be a little bit of a disconnect there, and that's, I guess, lends to the power of the incumbent because they are known. And I guess this will sort of be a test of whether some of this money that's being pumped into some of these races, particularly in a place like Southern Illinois, where you have some long-serving Democrats who are being targeted, whether the money might make a difference.
That's Dan Petrella. Oh, go ahead, Chris.
Right,
what were you going to say? Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, just quickly, I mean, one of the things about incumbent advantage is a sort of a chicken and egg thing. One of the reasons why incumbents do well is because they've done well before. It's not some nefarious.
No, and people know them. It's also just voters know, I'm sure.
They've run in there before. They've been elected previously probably for a reason, and that carries on.
That's Chris Mooney. He's director of IGPA at the University of Illinois. I want to thank also Dan Petrella, Springfield bureau chief with Lee Enterprise Newspapers. His reporting on this, the power of the incumbency, the research that he was reporting on, we'll tweet out as well. If you follow 21ST Show, you can see that. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Paying bail to get out of jail while you're awaiting trial is a system that a growing number across the country are challenging because they say it robs hundreds of thousands of presumptively innocent people of their fundamental right to liberty. That's because if you can't afford to pay bail, you wait in jail, sometimes for months, if not years, until trial. There are thousands of people across Illinois in this situation. The MacArthur Justice Center at Northwestern University recently filed a lawsuit in Cook County to challenge the system of bail. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by attorney Matthew Pierce, whose firm is also suing Cook County in that lawsuit. We'll also speak with State Representative Carol Ammons, who's taking part in a national campaign to reform pretrial laws, including the bail system. Well, why? They say it's to avoid catastrophic situations like what happened to 46-year-old Levette Mays.
I was devastated because I knew that my family couldn't come up with $25,000. And it was devastating for my whole family. Your life is determined on 30 seconds. When you come to court, you are to stand there with your hands behind your back, not speak or say anything. And while the judge don't look or he briefly looks at your case, I lost my business that I had going into jail. I lost my home.
That's Levette Mays speaking to WTTW's Chicago Tonight. And we're joined now by the reporter who did that story, Paris Schutz. Paris, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nyla. Good to be here.
So, Paris, when people like Levette can't afford to pay bail, we heard her say she lost her home, she lost her family. How does this whole thing work? In Levette's case, what happened to her?
Well, I mean, she was arrested for assault. Now that is a pretty violent crime, and a lot of the focus on this is to make sure that nonviolent offenders, low level, you know, someone who might have been caught, perhaps, you know, stealing a loaf of bread at a store or with you know, an ounce of marijuana or something like that, to make sure that they don't have to sit in jail awaiting trial. But there's a lot of people. Levette Mays didn't have an arrest record previously. You know, she had a job, she had a family, so it seemed like she fit a profile of someone who wouldn't be a threat to the community. So anyway, she stood before a judge for her bond hearing in bond court, like everyone does that's arrested, and she had 30 seconds. Where the judge sort of adjudicated what bond that they would assign, and the judge assigned a bond of $250,000. Now you have to pay you have to put up 10% of that, $25,000. Obviously, May says she didn't have that money, so she had to wait in Cook County Jail while her case went through the system, and that took 14 months. And this is the problem with Cook County Jail: everybody is there awaiting their trial, and the process can sometimes take years. And so, you know, remember, these are people that are innocent until proven guilty, but they are behind bars because they cannot afford to pay the bail. And the purpose of setting a high bail is to, is to ensure that someone who is a threat to the community isn't back on the street. But a lot of proponents of Levette Mays say she didn't fit the profile of being a threat to the community.
And so, Paris, what are Cook County politicians, what are people like Sheriff Tom Dart, what are they saying about this?
Well, I think everybody is saying that the entire criminal justice system needs to be reformed. And they've started to reduce the population in Cook County Jail from a peak of around 10 or 11,000 down to 8,000 because it's not cost effective. It costs more than $140 a day to house people in jail. And it's not morally right if someone is innocent until proven guilty, but their case is taking a long time to get through the system. So they all agree that there needs to be a reformation of the bail system. Now, this is, you know, how bail is set. It's up to the discretion of judges. Now, Chief Judge Tim Evans says there's a new risk assessment tool that's been put in place to sort of assess a number to someone based on how risky they would be to the community if they were to be let out. And they're supposed to be using this tool now. But again, as Tom Dart said, you know, these are human beings. They're not scientific algorithms. So each case is going to be different.
Does it happen in 30 seconds? Really, in 30 seconds, that's how much time this all gets determined?
Well, that's what Levette Mays said. That's what a lot of lawyers say. And that's the Sheriff Tom Dart said the average is about 25 to 30 seconds that these hearings actually take place. So it's in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it really is. Let's bring in lawyer Matthew Pierce. He's with the Chicago firm Hughes Sokol Pierce. They've joined, as we mentioned, a lawsuit that its goal is to actually end the practice of bail completely in Cook County. Matthew, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why end the practice completely?
We're not seeking to end the practice completely, although I could give you, I think, a very powerful argument that that would be a very good idea. What we are seeking to end, because we believe that it is not only morally wrong, but wildly illegal under our constitutional system of government, is the practice of setting bail in amounts higher than people are able to post. Paris did some very good reporting, and I agree with most of his comments, but I have to take issue with one of them. The purpose of setting a high bail should not be, under the law, to protect the public by keeping people off the streets. If a court makes a determination that somebody is too dangerous to be released, that person should get no bail, because that is the logical outcome of such a determination. On the other hand, under our bail statute and under our constitutional system, unless such a determination is made, there is an entitlement to bail. And that entitlement is a fiction, a cruel fiction, if the bail is then set in an amount that the defendant cannot post.
And how do you think this practice, we heard Paris explain how the bail gets determined. What are the qualifications? What are the things that judges have to go through in order to determine how much bail is right now, as it stands right now?
Well, Paris and Sheriff Dart are quite right that to observe a bond court and see what happens is frightening. I don't know if the average hearing is in fact as short as 25 seconds, but it's rare that a bond hearing in bond court goes for more than a couple of minutes. What happens typically is that the defendant is brought before the judge. The prosecutor, state's attorney, advises the judge with regard to whatever prior criminal record the person has, what the charges are, and what the facts are as stated in the arrest sheet, unproven facts, I might add. Pretrial services stands up, and based on this, I think, very dangerous and racially biased assessment tool that it has been employed with good intentions, I think, but it's a bad way of doing business. They give you two numbers, which are produced by an algorithm, which are based on social and criminal justice data. So you step up there and they say, okay, Ms. Budo is a 2 on likelihood to return to court and a 4 on dangerousness. The PD then gets up there and says, you know, nice guy, good family, never been in trouble before. All of this is done without witnesses, without evidence, without record. And then without any finding other than an outcome, the judge says, okay, $5,000 bail next case. Mm. It happens in just about the amount of time I just took to describe it to you. And what's important to understand is not only that these people are all presumptively innocent. Paris is absolutely right about that. They're as presumptively innocent as somebody not charged with a crime under our system. But that the result of the determination to set bond in an unreachable amount is a conviction in effect without a trial, without evidence, and without a hearing.
And that's your argument as to why it's unconstitutional. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Paris, I want to ask you one last question about that case with Lavette Mays, how she pleaded. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking about the practice of bail and the criminal justice system in Illinois. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. Each year, nearly 12 million people are booked into U.S. jails, mostly for nonviolent misdemeanors. More than 60% of jail inmates are unconvicted. That data is from a nationwide campaign called 3 Days Count. They're calling for common sense pretrial reform of our criminal justice system. State Representative Carol Emmons has been taking part in the 3 Days Count effort. She's in studio with me. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the line with us from Chicago, Matthew Pierce is an attorney. He's with Hughes Sokol Pierce Law Firm. They are part of a group, along with the MacArthur Justice Center at Northwestern University School of Law, that has sued Cook County over the practice of bail for people who can't afford it. WTTW's Paris Schutz has been reporting on this issue. He's with us as well. Paris, we were, before the break, just talking about this one case of this one woman, Lavette Mays. And I just wanted to ask, in your story, you mentioned that she ended up pleading guilty. Why did she say that she pled guilty?
Well, I'll get to that. I want to really quickly just bring up one more point. You know, another rationale that should be mentioned, you know, for setting bail at a certain amount is determining whether someone is a flight risk. So
sure.
Determining
mm-hmm.
whether they're going to show up for their court date. So I'm not, you know, commenting on the constitutionality of it, but a judge's criteria for setting a high bail might be, well, if they post that amount of money, that the incentive is they're going to come back and recover what they posted. So it should be mentioned that that's the other criteria they use. But for Lavette Mays, she was waiting trial for 14 months.
Just to be clear, 14 months. Yeah.
14 months. Yeah, and she eventually pled guilty to a lesser charge. So she was charged with assault. I can't remember the charge. It might have been some kind of battery charge that she pled guilty to, and she told me because she just wanted the whole thing over with. Now she maintains, you know, her innocence. She doesn't think that she did what she was charged with doing, but when you're sitting in jail, she realized that there was really, it's either, you know, continue to wait for this to be adjudicated or just get the whole thing over with, and she went back to, she had her bond reduced, and she there's a group called the Community Bond Fund that raised money to post the bail for her. So she did get out after 14 months, and she was charged with time served. So she didn't have to serve any additional time. So she decided that was the best way to just sort of move beyond all of this. But, you know, her quote to me was, you know, she felt like she was guilty until proven innocent with the way the system works.
That's WTTW's Paris Schutz, who's been reporting on this. Hey, Paris, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Niall.
Representative Ammons, you said you were in here. The minute you walked in, you said, I know of stories in Champaign just like Lavette Mays.
I do. There are stories. The interesting thing about 3 days count is that the 3 days actually do count. There's a gentleman here who's 48 years old, who was a passenger in a traffic stop, ultimately being arrested for having a very, very, very small amount of a controlled substance on him or near him. But in the process of that, he is a working same job 18 years. He's arrested in this traffic stop, goes to the county jail, and ultimately is not immediately bond out. In the process, he loses his job while he's in the county jail. He loses his ability to take care of his living arrangements. And it was so close that if he didn't have a support system, he could have lost the child that he is the primary caregiver for. So the ripple effect of this is much larger and longer than the, in many cases, the adjudication of the cases.
And that's why you think 3 days even in jail is an issue. And that's the whole 3 days count point.
I mean, the research shows us that a person who's held in custody pre-trial, meaning they are legally innocent until proven guilty, they are more likely, 70% likely, to lose their homes and their jobs during the duration of their,
their time
detainment
in jail.
Mm-hmm. In jail. And because of that, they ultimately, as in the case of this woman, Miss Mays, her time in jail was longer than a sentence she probably would have gotten. So they said, oh, let's just wipe our hands of this, reduce her bail and let her go. But the results of that are still the same. And that's why 3 days count matters. We really want to make sure that people who can be released while they await their trials, whatever that turns out to be, that they can be released and they can continue to work and take care of their living while they're trying to adjudicate either their innocence or their guilt, whichever way it comes.
Representative Ammons, I think some people who are listening to this might just ask, why don't we just reform the criminal justice system so people aren't waiting so long? What's the answer to that?
It is such a big very complicated thing because every single case seems to be different. But what we do know is in the bail issue, we do know that there are certain people, largely minority and largely poor people, who can't afford the high bails, which has a discriminatory impact on those communities. We already know that. The research is there. It's pretty clear that we can do something about this aspect of it. Do we need to do something about other aspects of it? Absolutely. I've been working on this for the last almost 20 years. But in this case, we have a concrete issue that can be addressed. We can bring the stakeholders who are decision makers in this process to the table, and we can say, look at the last 40 years of this effort, and it has not worked, and it does not secure public safety by holding people pretrial. Those are all facts that have already been researched, and we can do something about it right now.
That's State Representative Carol Ammons. She represents the 103rd District in Urbana. On the line with us as well, Matthew Pierce, who helped file that lawsuit against Cook County up in Chicago. Matthew, I know some people have talked about other systems like electronic monitoring in place of a bail system. How would that work?
Well, look, there are a lot of alternatives to cash bail, which in addition to having the serious problems that your other guests and you have already identified here, is ineffective as a means to get people to show up in court. Most people don't show up in court because they can't get their stuff together to remember. I mean, we're talking about folks who have criminal charges pending against them. Many of them suffer from the problems of poverty and lack of education. And, they don't have an iPhone calendar that reminds them to be in court on Monday necessarily. And so simply reminding people when they are released on iBond, by sending them text messages, by having them check in by telephone, simply the human contact and reminders, which is what the systems in the federal government and the District of Columbia are largely based upon, that works better than cash bail. But in extreme cases where people are still entitled to release, we now have the technological capability with GPS-based electronic monitoring to keep very close track of people on release, to not only know where they are, but when they've been there 24/7. I don't think that that's a general good alternative to cash bail, but it's certainly available to the cases of higher risk. But simply human contact and reminders is terribly, terribly effective. I want to give you, a statistic to emphasize the very wise comments of Representative Ammons about the impact here and about coercive guilty pleas. This is according to the Cook County Sheriff, Tom Dart. In last year, in 2015, prisoners combined spent a total of 218 years in the county jail in what are called dead days. What are dead days? Dead days are days that they spent in jail beyond the sentence that they got. So in the case of Lovette Mays, who I've met, and who is quite a remarkable woman, she did indeed spend 14 months in the county jail. She was sentenced to time served of less than 14 months. Hmm. So she over-served her sentence. And if you aggregate all of the Lovette Mayses of the world in the county jail for 2015, you come up with incarceration without conviction beyond sentence of 218 years. This is a human rights violation of dramatic proportion.
So when we think about that, Matthew, sure, not just a human rights violation, obviously, and we think about the human toll of this. Representative Ammons, I know that's something you're concerned with. You've also pointed out to everyone who this issue doesn't affect personally as taxpayers. Taxpayers are having to pay for this.
I mean, we spend $14 billion detaining people that have not been found guilty nationwide. $14 billion that are innocent until proven guilty. And that is a very hard thing for people to grapple with. But let's just talk about just for a second that I was arrested in a traffic stop because my license was suspended. And this is my second time being arrested with a suspended license. And because it's my second time, I'm still poor. The first time you arrest me and the second time, and I can't afford to pay all the fines that was from the first one. So now I'm arrested a second time and you hold me on a high bond and I'm already poor and I can't make that bail. They say, well, you shouldn't drive on a suspended license. Where we've created a system that is so built on debt that it
is
hard.
Still built on money is what you're saying. If you can't pay it off, then.
If you can't pay it off, it just kind of exponentially grows. And so a person who may have good intentions, trying to go to work and just make ends meet, they can't do that because the fines, now I got arrested, now I need a high bail. These things are just continuously growing. And let's think about this in this way. Since we spent so much money on pretrial, meaning people who are not found guilty of the crime that they've been arrested for.
Right, we don't know.
Not yet.
Right.
Not yet. They are, according to the Constitution, innocent until proven guilty. But you create a system that actually reverses that and make them guilty until they can prove their innocence. But the facts show us that if they are released on bond within the first 3 days, so immediately, if you get an I-bond immediately, you're less likely to be convicted with what you would charge with. And that is really interesting to look at the research. I think the research was done.
And is that because people are playing out?
Well, because there are also these unwritten dynamics happening in the court. So a person comes in from the county jail, like our Miss Mays, that the story was told, and she has gone before the judge a few times to get her bail reduced. I know she has because that's the process. But each time she comes in handcuffs, shackled from the county jail to sit in a court in front of a judge who has his own perception and biases as well. And that is also playing a part in why there's a discriminatory reflection in who's getting bail and who is not, and who's being held longer and who is not. And we can't ignore that that money bail system is really largely impacting poor minority communities because they don't have the income. There is a huge income disparity in this country. And so it trickles down in every aspect of our lives.
We just have a few minutes left, but I want to ask you very quickly about how other states are handling this. You mentioned the I-bond issue. How is Illinois looking to how other states are doing this in terms of trying to create reform within different counties or municipalities across Illinois?
So the great thing about what we've done is we're trying to bring the stakeholders to the table where we need to.
And so those stakeholders are, can you identify? So it's a criminal
justice. Legislative, mm-hmm. It's judicial, it's also executive branch.
Okay.
So the 3 Days Count initiative with the national organization Pretrial Justice Institute, we are working collectively to not only reveal the entire scope of the bail system itself and its impact on communities, but how we can actually fix this thing and get rid of that, which is just another hurdle for poor people.
And so the people that you have with you, Illinois Chief Supreme Court Justice, yes. Who else is on board with this?
So we have, of course, I have a lot of legislative support that we're going to be looking at this in the next session. We also have Chief Justice Rita Garman, who's leading the effort among the judges and bringing them to the table. We have the Illinois Administrative Court, which is the administrative court of the Supreme Court of Illinois, who's also on board. And then we have a liaison from the governor's office who's on board with helping us to really reveal this because of the criminal justice reform task force that.
And
the
is all of this different
has.
By different county? Is it different by
it
every
is,
court system?
It's a patchwork.
So every court system. So there's a lawsuit going on in Cook County,
yes.
But it's completely different in Champaign County or Sangamon or whatever other county. Everybody has a different rule.
There are
for this.
Eight counties currently in Illinois that have some form of risk assessment. Part of the 3 Days Count process that we will do from my legislative office is we're going to review all of those risk assessment tools because some of them still have within them some inherent racialized language that also contributes to who gets bailed and who doesn't. So we'll study that as well in this process.
We just have about 30 seconds left, Representative. What would you like to see happen in the coming months on this issue?
Well, I would love for people who are listening in our geographic area in Champaign-Urbana to come and join our criminal justice panel where we will be reviewing all of this in the next few months. And that is at my office on 407 East University Avenue. You can go to my website, StateRepCarolAmis.com. You can sign up for that panel there. We'd love to have people's input at the front door and certainly not at the back.
Matthew, I know the first legislative hearing on your lawsuit for the bail process takes place on November 17th. That's in Cook County. I want to thank Matthew Pierce with the Hughes Sokol Pierce Law Firm, part of a lawsuit along with the MacArthur Justice Center against Cook County for trying to change the practice of bail for people who can't afford it. Matthew, thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Representative Ammons, I appreciate it as well. We'll tweet thank out you. All of those links to what you've been talking about. Thanks for being with us as well.
So much for having me on.
That does it for us today. Of course, tomorrow we'll be talking about the outcome of the Cubs game tonight. It's game 7. Let's go, Cubs. And you can talk about it with us tomorrow on the 21st. Have a great afternoon. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.